Well, here's a breaking story. An aircraft carrying 11 aboard crashed in the Pacific Ocean on its way to the aircraft carrier Ronald Reagan. This carrier is close to North Korea. The Japan-based 7th Fleet said in a statement the search and rescue operation has been launched from the carrier. It says the ship was operating in the Philippine Sea when the crash occurred just a few moments ago. So we'll keep our eyes on that story. We're going to come back in a moment more with Linda Moulton Howe as she investigates the JFK assassination and other issues next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us as she continues with her incredible investigation here into the JFK assassination and other related issues. Linda, let's pick it up again where I think you're talking to Douglas Caddy again.
Well, now I am going back to Daniel List for a reason, is that in our discussion about what really could be the reason that the CIA would have plotted the assassination of the president, we both have focused on a couple of documents. And so in his extensive research into the various investigations of the November 22, 1963 JFK assassination, Daniel List has focused a lot on the New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, who was building a case that the people and money responsible for the skillfully executed assassination were from aerospace companies. Today, we now have two important documents that President John Kennedy prepared on the same date, November 12th, 1963, only 10 days before he would be killed in the Dallas motorcade. One of the documents is classified top secret memorandum for the director, name blacked out, of the Central Intelligence Agency, and you can see both of the documents that I am referring to now at my news website, earthfiles.com, in the series of reports that are there. They're very clear, and they are definitely valuable and worth reading. And one of the documents that has the name blacked out is presumably in November 1963. That was Kennedy's own appointee, John McCone, after he had fired Alan Dulles in November 1961, but the name that is tied to the director of Central Intelligence is blacked out for reasons unknown. The subject is classification review of all UFO intelligence files affecting national security. President Kennedy writes, quote, "As I had discussed with you previously, I have initiated, name blacked out, and have instructed James Webb, the astronomer, to develop a program with the Soviet Union in joint space and lunar exploration. It would be very helpful if you would have the high threat cases," he's referring to UFOs, "reviewed with the purpose of identification of bona fide as opposed to classified CIA and U.S. Air Force sources," as if he doesn't trust those. "It is important that we make a clear distinction between the knowns and unknowns in the event the Soviets try to mistake our extended cooperation as a cover for intelligence gathering of their defense and space programs. When this data has been sorted out, I would like you to arrange a program of data sharing with NASA where unknowns are a factor. This will help NASA mission directors in their defensive responsibilities, defensive as if there is something that might be harmful in the UFOs. I would like an interim report on the data review no later than February 1st, 1964, signed John F. Kennedy. Next to Kennedy's signature line, there is a brief visible handwritten note from James Jesus Angleton that seems to be acknowledging the memo's directive, but whatever else had been written in the bottom of the page is totally blacked out. On that same day, November 12, 1963, President Kennedy also sent a National Security Action Memorandum number 271 for the administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which is NASA, on the, quote, "subject of cooperation with the USSR on outer space matters, close quote. President Kennedy's memo begins, quote, I would like you, the NASA administrator, to assume personally the initiative and central responsibility within the government for the development of a program of substantive cooperation with the Soviet Union in the field of outer space, including the development of specific technical proposals. These proposals should be developed with a view to their possible discussion with the Soviet Union. As a direct outcome of my September 30th, 1963 proposal for broader cooperation between the United States and the USSR in outer space, including cooperation in lunar landing programs, close quote, meaning that he's proposing that the United States and the USSR get together peacefully and go to the moon. Daniel List is convinced that Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans, got the closest to the government's cover-up of an incriminating spiderweb of many strange links between Lee Harvey Oswald and CIA agents such as Guy Bannister and other shadowy characters in New Orleans, Cuba, Russia, and beyond, all trying to have a firewall between MJ-12 matters having to do with UFO and ETs and back engineering technologies and the outside white world. Here again from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Daniel List.
There's very unusual connections there that Garrison was looking at, and I think it's important because Garrison, during his investigation, called a magazine editor, a guy named Warren Hinkle, who ran something called Ramparts Magazine, which was kind of a big magazine in the 60s. And I put aside this quote, which is what he said to him, and this is on record. Quote, important new evidence has surfaced. Those Texas oil men do not appear to be involved in President Kennedy's murder in the way we first thought. It was the military-industrial complex that put up the money for the assassination. But as far as we can tell, the conspiracy was limited to the aerospace wing. I think that they were working with advanced material, and I think that they had this kind of advanced technology they were working with of unknown origin, and that it was obtained quite possibly from these UFO crash retrievals, and that Kennedy, in the memos he had dated November 12th, 10 days before he was assassinated, instructed NASA to give information regarding everything we knew about the UFO factor to our counterparts in the Soviet Union. And Kennedy was very concerned that they would mistake one of these UFOs over a nuclear site for American ships and planes spying on them and getting intelligence, but also he was worried about triggering an accidental nuclear launch. So that was one of his motivations. The other one was that he had a memo there, which is National Security Action Memorandum 271, about cooperation with the Soviet Union in outer space matters. This is a very significant document because he was planning to go to the moon with the Soviets. So he was going to invite the Russians into that. He was going to get rid of the space race and lessen tensions, and this was a great way to do it. Khrushchev's son, Sergei, has confirmed that Kennedy wanted to do this and that his father was open to it and finally was starting to see Kennedy not so much as an enemy, as somebody who had his own trouble and his own military-industrial complex to fight with, and he was trying to cooperate with him.
Why is it, do you think, then, in the big picture, that somebody like Alan Dulles, who was the CIA director when John F. Kennedy was first elected, and James Jesus Angleton was working counter-intel for and with Alan Dulles, why would they take an adversarial role against John F. Kennedy wanting to open up an alliance with the Soviet Union on space research going to the moon? Why would Angleton and Dulles have resisted and been ultimately responsible for JFK's assassination?
Well, it's an excellent question. It runs deep. And I think that first, I would size the two of them up as Dulles as the real director and Angleton as an expert strategist. I think the reason is clear that they had access to this advanced technology. They did not want to share it with the Russians at the time. And one of the reasons also is the sheer number of Nazi scientists that were involved in the project that we had brought over here in the creation of the space program.
Paperclip.
Paperclip, exactly. They had had a huge, gigantic battle with Russia, and their sentiments were very anti-Soviet, anti-Russia. But I think the larger picture is they looked at Kennedy as an upstart who was changing things. He was opening the world up. He believed in freedom. He had ideals. People like Dulles and Angleton, when you look at their record in Guatemala, in Iran, they were interested in overthrowing countries for their own purposes, for rewarding their own group of deep state assets and friends. And they were building a picture of domination around the globe. You've done remarkable reports on Truman's time and the beginning of MJ-12. You have to add the UFO equation, the UFO technology. When we look at it through that lens, it makes a lot more sense, whether they think of it as advanced technology that was discovered or off-world visitor technology. It's an important factor. You can't explain the rest of this without it. I don't think that the CIA would remove John F. Kennedy because he didn't invade Cuba.
What is the strongest link to the assassination of JFK from Alan Dulles because of the UFO's ET secret that Alan Dulles, director of the CIA at the beginning of the Kennedy administration and continuing, I think, as head of MJ-12, he would argue that covering up UFOs and ETs trumped in national security the life of the president, that it gave Alan Dulles legal reason to assassinate the president of the United States who wanted to open up UFOs and ETs with the Soviet Union and to go to the moon.
I think there's one thing that is absolutely pivotal, which is Dulles gets onto the Warren Commission to handle all the intelligence leads in the case. It's a very odd move on the part of LBJ to do this because it's well known that Dulles was fired by JFK. To put him onto the commission to study his assassination is a very unusual move. So he orchestrated the commission quite well by not giving the information out. Of course, they ignored all kinds of intelligence leads. There is an assistant to Dulles who spoke of speaking to him in 1966 about JFK, and Dulles turning to him saying, "That damn Kennedy, he thought he was a god." Kennedy came in and he said, "I don't care the kind of secrecy that you've been building. I don't care the kind of worldview that you have. I'm going to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and we're going to go for freedom, and we're going to go for an openness."
Do you have any other insights about the relationship of E. Howard Hunt, who was in the Central Intelligence Agency from its very birth on September 18, 1947, through to the assassination? What E. Howard Hunt in the CIA would know about the planning of the assassination of the president?
Well, he himself claimed that he was told about the big event and that he was a bench warmer on it. So certainly he had details. Now, there was a witness who came forward in the 70s during the House Assassination Committee investigation. Her name was Marita Lorenz, and she was the girlfriend of Castro, but she was a CIA agent, and she was sent to kill Castro. She claimed that when she was driving to Dallas, and she didn't know why, with Frank Sturgis, who later became one of the Watergate burglars and was close to Hunt, that they met a paymaster at a motel while they were on their way, and Sturgis was going there with some Cubans, and she didn't know what the mission was all about. But when they met this person at this motel, she claims the person that they met, who was the paymaster for the arrangement, was Hunt. I happen to think he was very involved, actually. I don't think he was a bench warmer. And Caddy's term for it is, well, sometimes the coach will call the guy who's on the bench onto the field. So he also believed that Hunt was active on the day of the assassination, for sure. But I think the other thing that's fascinating to keep in mind about Hunt relates to the records that they just released, because there's a big, very ominous zero for his activity during the time of the assassination. They have a file of E. Howard Hunt, comes out, all of that period is blanked out. So whatever it is that he's up to for the CIA, that record gets thrown down the memory hole. E. Howard Hunt, certainly according to Caddy, was a true blue Cold Warrior, and he and other CIA agents had a lot of animosity with Kennedy over the Bay of Pigs incident. But that's not the reason I think they assassinated him. I think what he told Caddy at the end of their meeting before he went off to prison was the truth, that they had coordinated to assassinate President Kennedy to stop him from revealing our most vital national secret, which was the alien presence. It was the UFO file that Kennedy was planning to share with the Soviet Union for a new kind of openness between them, and also to reduce nuclear tensions. He felt that was a remarkable thing. As you can see in that memo, he felt like it was a major hazard. And it's the kind of thinking of Kennedy, which is, if we share this information, it'll lower the tensions. We'll go into space together. Kennedy had already been through the Cuban Missile Crisis. He understood the threat of nuclear holocaust. It was real to him. And when he's dealing with the Soviet Union, he's saying, look, we have to level with them. We have to give them our UFO files, and we have to face this stuff together. That was a major red flag for the CIA. They could not tolerate it. People like Dulles, who had kept the secret since the 40s, weren't about to let John Kennedy give this secret away to the Soviet Union.
What a wild theory, huh, Linda?
Well, no. I think you've just heard the absolute core of what happened. That this is exactly Dulles and the people from the Truman-Eisenhower group that were given a kind of charge that those that were in the MJ-12 group, of which then Dulles would, as director of the CIA, he would have been what's called MJ-1, and that the MJ-1 through 12 had various specialties and knowledge, but the director of the CIA under Truman, Helen Ketter, and then under Eisenhower, starting with Dulles, that these would have been the people who everything that they thought and breathed and did was to keep the reality of extraterrestrial biological entities and what we were learning and the technology that we were gathering that is defined so well in Philip J. Corso, Army Lieutenant Colonel mm-hmm. Philip J. Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, you start now putting all of these pieces together like stringing beads on a string, and the entire picture is becoming quite clear. And this is the reason that there was a battle going on in forces in the 50s and the 60s about this whole issue that corporations, American corporations, were being approached by General Trudeau, head of R&D in the Pentagon, through Philip Corso, with what? With technology that they were getting from various kinds of crashes, not just in the United States. We were actually going out to other countries. And the highest priority was on trying to figure out what this advanced technology was and how it could be applied in commercial applications inside of the United States. And when Corso said to me the most important thing that Eisenhower and Trudeau thought could happen is that American corporations would be able to patent the back-engineered extraterrestrial technology, and that would keep it out of the hands of our perceived world enemies, and the government agencies would have no right to information from private corporations. The trick was, how do you have one person in a company, let's say like Boeing, and that person is the only person who knows that what's going to be hand-delivered to him from the Pentagon is actually extraterrestrial technology that they're going to have to figure out. And that is the whole patchwork quilt that Corso tried to describe in The Day After Roswell, which fits very neatly into the tension that was developing between the MJ-12 people who felt the responsibility.
More to come in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us now. Here's her final segment. Next hour, we will have conversations with Linda. Linda, go ahead.
Thanks, George. The CIA and FBI have withheld not only all of the Jim Garrison documents and photographs from his JFK assassination investigation, they still don't want to open up the files of another CIA agent who began working for the agency in 1952 and by 1963 was active in New Orleans, where he had a house that summer when Lee Harvey Oswald was living there, and working for Guy Bannister, also a CIA agent. Now, that CIA agent's name is George Joannides, and he was using CIA money to fund the Cuban student group known as DRE. Everything Joannides was doing that summer of 1963 was as chief of the CIA's psychological warfare branch and the CIA station in Miami known as, all caps, JM Wave, located south of Miami on 1,500 acres of thick woods. There were many buildings that were said to belong to Zenith Technological Enterprises. JM Wave was the code name for a major secret United States covert operations and intelligence gathering station operated by the CIA from 1961 until 1968. It was headquartered in Building 25 on the South Campus of the University of Miami in Miami, Florida. The intelligence facility was also referred to as the CIA's Miami Station or Wave Station. After the April 1961 Bay of Pigs disaster, President John F. Kennedy created a committee called SGA to continue efforts to overthrow Castro's government. The SGA was chaired by JFK's brother, Robert F. Kennedy, who was then U.S. Attorney General. Others were John McCone, who became CIA director after President Kennedy fired Allen Dulles. Others involved were McGeorge Bundy in national security, General Lyman Lemnitzer from the Pentagon's Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Maxwell Taylor. Although not officially members, Secretary of State Dean Rusk and Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara also attended meetings. The goal was to develop a successful covert action program for sabotage and subversion against Cuba, which they all decided to call Operation Mongoose. By the spring of 1962, JM Wave employed more than 200 CIA officers that were running more than 2,000 Cuban agents. And all of it was run by the mysterious George Joannides in collaboration with General Edward Lansdale, who had served U.S. intelligence operations for two decades, beginning with the OSS during World War II. And Joannides ended up in 1978 serving as the CIA's liaison to the United States House Select Committee on Assassinations. In 2013, the Boston Globe wrote, quote, "There is a body of documents about George Joannides that the CIA is still protecting, which should be released to the public," close quote. Because independent researchers find links between Joannides and the JFK assassination. Here once more from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Daniel List of darkjournalist.com.
Well, George Joannides is a fascinating character. He was a CIA officer in charge of psychological warfare, and he was active in 1963 in New Orleans and actually had a house there during the summer of 63 when Lee Harvey Oswald was living there and working for Guy Bannister. And Joannides was funding a group called the DRE. They were anti-Castro right-wing group. And this is the same group that Lee Harvey Oswald had the fight with that made the news and eventually got him on TV, portraying him as a communist and having him talking about his Marxist principles and all the rest. In other words, it looks like it was a staged incident. But Joannides' role wasn't known. And what happened was there was a Washington Post reporter named Jefferson Morley who found records that were related to the DRE, and he realized that Joannides was funding them. And then he started to look into Joe Anitti's role, and he found out a great deal about him. But the CIA wanted to keep all of his records out of the public view. And so Morley, along with a number of other journalists, contributed to this court case to get those records released. And those records are actually separate from the JFK records release. These records are kept separately. Now, Joe Anitti turns up again in the late 1970s as the liaison between the Congressional Committee and the CIA. Now, this was a very important role, and when the Congressional Committee set it up, they said, we need someone who was not active in 1963 and had no connection to Oswald or the JFK case in any way. And the CIA said, great, here's Joe Anitti. Well, when this research was done by this former Washington Post reporter on Joe Anitti, they found he was totally active in 1963, and he was creating a kind of a psychological warfare operation around the DRE against Oswald. As a matter of fact, the CIA was funding the DRE, and when Oswald got arrested for shooting Officer Tippit and was accused of assassinating the president, the DRE posted a full-page ad saying that Oswald was guilty and he's a left-winger and all that. This was a real propaganda trick going on there. But Joe Anitti's is very fascinating for me because not only do they keep his records sealed, but his expertise in psychological warfare, I think, is really something we need to look at to understand the Oswald that was being built up there in the summer before the assassination, which is crucial, in New Orleans as this kind of left-wing guy who was ultra-communist and ultra-Marxist and pro-Castro and all the rest of it. When in actual fact, the trail of Oswald in 1963 in the summer goes back to working for Guy Bannister, who was a right-wing anti-Castro infiltrator of student groups. So that doesn't add up. Obviously, they needed to portray Oswald in anticipation of using him as the patsy in the JFK assassination as this radical left-wing communist. Now, one other thing about Joe Anitti is I found a picture that I put in my latest broadcast of Joe Anitti getting a career achievement commendation from Admiral Bobby Inman. And Bobby Inman, as we know, very closely associated with strange attempts to get the alien word out, talking about alien crashes and things like that. He was the former deputy CIA director under Ronald Reagan in 1981, and that's when that picture was taken. So again, around Oswald, around the JFK assassination, we have this weird insertion of this UFO character, these people who know about UFOs or talk about UFOs in an intelligence capacity. And we have not heard the end of the Joe Anitti story because all the files around Joe Anitti are kept under national security, and there's still a major court case pending in D.C. to get those files.
By whom?
The court case was undertaken by Jefferson Morley, who is the former Washington Post reporter, and other people who contributed to that case, Professor Peter Dill Scott at UC Berkeley, and also David Talbot, who's the former editor at Salon, who wrote the book The Devil's Chessboard, which was a major expose biography on Alan Dulles, which basically fingers him for the JFK assassination.
Is there any information that links Oswald from his being in the Civil Air Patrol and can follow and track his life from Civil Air Patrol, perhaps right into the CIA?
Well, there's a lot of obfuscation around the Oswald background. That's the first thing you have to know. Oswald will show up in two places simultaneously. It's well known that there are Oswald impersonators here in America when he is in the Soviet Union. Even J. Edgar Hoover, in 1960, wrote this memo 3 years before the assassination saying someone was using Oswald's identity. So he's a very interesting player, Oswald, because he seems to be set up from the very beginning to have conflicting stories in his background. As a matter of fact, it looks like he was attending two junior high schools in two totally different cities at the same time. There's a remarkable obfuscation of his past. His Marine records show him to be 5'9", and then the body's 5'11". So we have a lot of skirmishes with the facts around Oswald. And I think the most important and strangest one came from someone who was the funeral director where Oswald was killed, and he performed the autopsy on Oswald. You know, he says that at some point agents came and they spent time. They said they needed to work with the body on their own. And when they came out, they made some unusual references to each other about not knowing exactly who that was lying there. So there's a great mystery about Oswald and his background and the kind of double life that he had. But I would say that he was set up from the beginning. If you look at someone at the age of 15 entering the Civil Air Patrol and the kind of influence that military and intelligence people can have on them, if they've identified them as having specific qualities that would be valuable for intelligence. In Oswald's case, he was a very cool customer. Even when he's being arrested for the assassination, he keeps a very cool demeanor.
And he said he was a patsy.
Yes. Well, here's this guy who is not very well educated, and he comes from a kind of a poor background, but he knows Russian incredibly well, so much so that when he meets Marina Oswald in Russia, she thinks he's a Russian because his Russian is so good.
And he must have learned that in some CIA school.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Garrison looked into that in the Warren Commission, and they had someone from Oswald's Marine unit who was in a leadership position, and he said, oh yeah, Oswald was trained in the Russian language. That started to get to Garrison because he said, don't train privates in Russian language unless they're used for intelligence. So he instantly started to get alarm bells going off.
There must be incriminating files that tie either the CIA to the assassination directly or tie the CIA to extraterrestrial investigations that JFK wanted to do and that the head of the CIA and MJ1 said was impossible to release.
Well, I think that you're right in this sense. Their original request was to have it released in 2038. Let's think about that. That's another 21 years. Why would you need to hold back those records for 21 years? That's not a transparent society, and it's certainly not accountable. So without transparency and accountability, they're acting above the law. And that's the kind of thing that in a democratic republic is a real problem, because if you have people operating outside of the law, then you're not living in the country that you think you're living in. The secrets of the deep state that are contained in the JFK files, I think, would put some of the puzzle pieces together, and they don't want that.
And Alan Dulles wanted JFK eliminated.
There's no question. Dulles objected to Kennedy's policies, and I think that they would have tolerated that. But I think once he got into the UFO file, that was it, because the UFO file is such a sensitive area, and that knowledge of the advanced technology and what Caddy said Hunt told him, the alien presence, that tells us that it's at such a secrecy level that it's above what the Manhattan Project was when it came out.
It does not excuse the abuse of the democracy, taking out the President of the United States.
Yes, and the fact that President Kennedy was executed in broad daylight on a public street also says that they wanted this to be a warning, graphic display of their aggression and
power.
Yes, and when we look at what's happened to America since, there's been a big drift away from our original ideals. The world that they created was a very different one than what President Kennedy had envisioned. And I think Kennedy's idealism is still an echo back there, but there's an unsolved crime and there's an untold story. And we need to get to the bottom of that story now, because it seems like more than ever we're in need of a course correction. And that just might be the kind of catalyst. Burying the secret, as we know, buried secrets tend to fester and they tend to cause problems. With our country, we have the ability, the possibility of turning things around, but we need the truth. And I think the best place to start with that is opening up the JFK files.
Great stories, Linda.
Well, I think this is really important, and that we are beginning to get a focus that is coming into clarity more about what was happening between somebody like Dulles and coming after Eisenhower and Truman, and then the new Kennedy, and the fact that it would have been anathema to somebody like Alan Dulles and to James Jesus Angleton that a president of the United States wanted to take the UFO technology and the investigations to the Soviets and join them together and go to the moon and start a whole new collaboration between the Cold War enemies. My perspective is that I think that was a great idea. I think that if the world had gone in that direction, there might not have been the wars and a lot of other things that have developed, but that was more idealistic. And the part that I think needs to be addressed is that 1961, we go back, remember Betty and Barney Hill in
great,
New Hampshire.
Great abduction case.
Well, it was the beginning of, it was first Betty and Barney Hill, and then there began to be a whole lot of people that were coming forward by the early 70s, by 67. Animal mutilations were being reported around the world by the years 73 to 76. There were literally hundreds and hundreds. People don't realize the extent. When I have interviewed sheriffs who were working in the 70s, they said these bodies, they were going down so fast that they were warm to touch, and we are getting to a bull or a cow or a calf or steer, and they are lying in face powder kind of dirt, and there's no tracks around their body, not even the animal zone tracks, and that's why law enforcement started saying to each other, whatever is doing this, they have to be coming in, taking these animals, taking them up into the air some way, doing the extractions.
Well, you're an expert in that, Linda, in that field, too. We're going to come back and have conversations with Linda. Wide open phone calls with you next.